So today I would like to motivate the definition of superstring theory. And to do so, I will go back to the quantization of particles again. So I want to start to discussing a simple looking problem, which is first sort of first quantized description of fermions. So how do we, if we want to do a quantum field theory with fermions, if we want to reproduce Feynman diagrams of quantum field theory with fermions, which sort of word line theory should we use, analogous to the word line theory we introduced for scalar fields? So this poses a few challenges. So, well, the basic challenge is that you want to find some way to reproduce the propagator for the Dirac equation, rather than the Klein-Gordon equation. The second challenge is that the on-shell condition of physical state for scalar fields must be replaced by the on-shell condition for fermions. Now, if you remember, this on-shell condition came from as a residue of gauge fixing. We'll have to find somehow a way to get a different condition for gauge fixing. And finally, how do you get gamma? So all these expressions involve gamma matrices. How do we get gamma matrices in a natural way? So how do we set up our word line theory in such a way that the states of the word line theory are a representation for this Clifford algebra of gamma matrices? Now, I'll answer the last question first because it's the simplest. Suppose that I have a sort of Lagrangian that we used after gauge fixing for the bosonic particle, and that I add to it something involving Grassmann-Ott particles. Let me restore some indices. So zero for fermions is natural to a first order actions with one derivative. And because these are Grassmann-Ott variables, this expression is not trivial. I mean, if I had written the same thing for bosonic variables, you could have said this is just the derivative of psi squared, so it's a total derivative, and so I don't care about it. But for fermions, that's not true because psi squared is zero, and this is definitely not zero. So if you quantize this Lagrangian, you get the usual, commutation relations for position and momentum. And on the other hand, because this action for the fermions is first order, you get that the psi's are their own momenta. So the quantization of some Grassmann odd variables of this sort gives rise to operators which anticommute to one, and which essentially behaves as gamma matrices. So wherever we had a gamma matrix above, we could identify it with this quantization of this fermionic degrees of freedom. So that was easy. This is a bit harder, and so is this. If you remember, in the bosonic case, the logical sequence was as follows. We had the propagator. We rewrote it in this form. And then we are in Fourier after Fourier transformation, it became something like this. But this was a propagator, was a Green function, which was then interpreted as a path integral for some action, which is just the integral of x dot squared from 0 to tau, pretty much. And then finally, we recover these from the gauge fixing of a path integral, which are diffeomorphism invariants. Right? Those are the logical steps we follow in one of the first few lectures. So how do we do the same with this sort of P mu, gamma mu? Or P mu, psi mu, over P squared. Well, to get a denominator, you integrate over bosonic variables. Natural way to get a numerator is to integrate over fermionic variable. So I could try to do something like this. And make sure I have the correct signs. Look at the minus two. So this is even, and this is odd, Grassmann odd. So this is some kind of proper time, and this is something else. Now, another reason you might think that something like this could be reasonable is that this on-shell condition came from gauge fixing diffeomorphism invariants of one bosonic variable or one proper time. Now, this constraint is now a fermionic constraint. So it will naturally arise from gauge fixing a fermionic symmetry. And if I have two variables, indeed, there is a nice symmetry group, which is called super diffeomorphisms, and which are introduced momentarily, which has the chance to give something like that. Now, before I do that, let me just discuss a bit further the properties of P squared and P psi. First of all, the Hamiltonian for this associated to this Lagrangian is simply P squared. If you remember how you go from Lagrangian to Hamiltonian, you can see easily that this term cancels out. Right? A essentially, all that these fragmented degrees of freedom do is that they give you, instead of a single ground state, they give you a spinor both of ground states over which these gamma matrices act. Is this statement clear? I'm saying if I take this Lagrangian by itself and I quantize it, I get Hilbert space, which is finite dimensional. It's a representation of these gamma matrices. Natural to take it an irreducible representation of the gamma matrices, which is a spinor. So this, the Hilbert space, right, will contain something like some states with some index, spinor index alpha, and psi mu acting on alpha will be something like gamma mu alpha beta. Beta. So, and all of those states have the same energy. And they're not, you can decorate that by the momentum states of the bosonic variable. So anyway, the Hamiltonian is just P squared. Now let me give a name, let me call it Q, although please don't confuse it with the BST charge. Whenever I write down the BRST charge, now I write really Q BRST. It's some other fermionic symmetry. Some other object. I shouldn't even call it a symmetry yet. But it's true that it's a conserved quantity. It commutes with Hamiltonian. So it defines a symmetry. What happens if I square the symmetry generator? Can you compute what Q square is? Using the anti-commutation relations if needed. That's correct. So Q square is the same as the Hamiltonian. So the Hamiltonian together with this Q form an interesting group of transformations. This is time translations. And this is something which is called a supersymmetry. A symmetry which squares to time translations or to translations in general. So In trying to define the fermionic, the word line theory for a fermionic particle, we land naturally on a supersymmetric theory, on the simplest example of supersymmetric theory. It's a bit of an accident, but it's still very useful for what we're going to do. Now, so something like this, right? Is some generalization of the Green's function then. Well, somehow I'm using the Hamiltonian to propagate a long time, and I'm using the supercharge to propagate along some other fermionic direction, which we could call supertime, just to give it a name. So these are just for formal manipulations, okay? I'm not trying to say anything physically deep. But they're useful formal manipulations. So,
what difference does it make between if tau and theta were both even? If they were both even?
Well, then you would get this at the denominator, and we would not get the propagator we're looking for. So this is the group of supersymmetries, or also called supertranslations. by writing things like this, right, we have done something like this first step. We wrote this as some kind of integral on the tau, the zeta, of a Green function, generalized Green function, where you propagate along some time and super time. And this Green function can be written now as a path integral. So let me just write an expression and then try to convince you that it works. I could be trying to write an expression which uses both integrals over time and super time. This will be called superspace. It's often useful but sometimes cumbersome. For now, let me avoid it. I'm just going to put that Lagrangian here. And so if I just was propagating on time, right, this would be enough. I would take my Lagrangian, do a path integral from some initial state and some final state. That will give me the time evolution. And I need to to do something like this to include the extra term. I haven't done anything deep. X dot is the same as P. It's a constant of motion. So integrating it along a long time just multiplies by tau, but divided by tau by hand, got rid of it. Okay. Now, on the other hand, if I wanted to use a fermionic analog of U, then I should introduce superspace. And let me do that. So let me define some composite fields, introducing a new variable, which morally speaking is going from zero to zeta, the same way as u is going from zero to tau. Although for fermionic variables, all these statements are very formal. And just combine, it's just a convenient way to combine together the x's and the psi's. Okay? There is something called the superfield. It collects a whole bunch of fields related by supersymmetry. Perhaps in order to motivate this choice further, I would also observe that using these definitions, if you do commutator of Q with X, you get psi. And if you do commutator of Q with psi, you get P. So somehow this supersymmetry mixes together the bosonic and fermionic parts of the action, the bosonic and fermionic variables. This is another way to think about supersymmetry. Supersymmetry is a symmetry which mixes bosons and fermions. So, right, with this definition, the action of Q on Y well, I'm going to write just commutator always with understanding that if a variable is fermionic, I'm really doing anti-commutator. So this gives you psi mu minus theta p mu, which can be written as d theta minus theta du y. So this is the action of supersymmetry as a differential operator on superfields. So this vector field is the generator of supertranslations. And indeed, it is the case that if you take the theta minus theta du squared, this is proportional to the u, which is, completely analogous to the statement that Q squared is H. So these super translations are a little bit different than what you could have imagined, right? You could have thought that if I have a bosonic variable and a fermionic variable, and super translations just shift the fermionic variable or the bosonic variable separately. If you do that, you don't get this group. The fermionic translations would just square to nothing. In order to get this group, we modify the definition of translations and say, okay, super translations shifts the fermionic variable, but it also shifts the bosonic variable by an amount of proportional to the fermionic variable. This is probably the first time you see supersymmetry, right? So this is an excellent toy model to see the first beginnings of supersymmetry. This sort of thing is called supersymmetric quantum mechanics. It has a lot of interesting features. Anyway, now it's useful to introduce a second differential operator. Let me call it the theta superderivative, which has the opposite sign. The effect of having the opposite sign, so this is this, the theta also squares to the u. But the effect of having the opposite sign is that this, the theta, commutes with supersymmetry. So the theta is useful to write down actions. So in particular, when you write down an action for supersymmetric quantum mechanics, if you write it using this kind of derivatives, it's easier to make something that is this is supersymmetric. But also, it's useful to characterize the next important symmetry group, which I want to introduce, which is supersymmetric generalization of diffeomorphisms. So at this point, here there is not much more that we need to discuss. Well, I want to understand how to do the next step, how to interpret this action as the result of gauge fixing something with some local symmetry, gauge symmetry. Before I move on, ask any questions you have about this setup. I mean, there is a whole story about how to write down supersymmetric actions as integrals of superspace, which is very useful and interesting, but I will avoid it because it has a lot of technicalities and I don't need it for what follows. Now, instead, see, what is my problem? Suppose I want to define some generalization of diffeomorphisms. So diffeomorphisms are just coordinate transformations that map u to some other function of u, right? Now that I have two variables, u and theta, I could be tempted to just consider all possible coordinate transformations which mix u and theta. Except that this would have sort of too many degrees of freedom. Right. If allow me to change u by any function of u and theta, and change theta by any function of u and theta, right? That function of, if I write u prime as some f of u and theta, and theta prime as some g of u and theta, I'll get too many degrees of freedom, because I can write this as f1 of u plus theta f2 of u. I can write this as g1 of u plus theta g2 of u. So these are four bosonic. I have one bosonic, one fermionic, and one bosonic degree of freedom in my transformations. That's too much. That's too much because at the end, the sort of constraints I want, I want to impose one extra fermionic constraint at the end out of gauge fixing. I don't want two extra ones. But it turns out that there is a nice subgroup of these transformations. A generic transformation mixes the theta and the u arbitrarily. What I can do is to look for a transformation which leaves the theta, which maps the theta to a multiple of itself. So I can try to restrict myself to transformations that send the theta to some Jacobian times the theta prime. Okay? These are called super diffeomorphisms. So it's a subgroup of all possible transformations. And it turns out to have one bosonic and one fermionic degree of freedom, and to be the natural generalizations of supertranslation. So, the simplest supertranslation is something of this form, a vector field, which has some generic function of u, which multiplies our supertranslation. So I take my fermionic generator that defined my supersymmetry, and I just do a different supersymmetry at each location of time. You can indeed check that if you anticommute this transformation with the superderivative, you get something which is proportional to the superderivative. It's a nice calculation. So this sort of property must remain true even when we anticommute these symmetries to find other symmetries. For example, if you anticommute two of these fermionic symmetries, you get something like this. It has the term that looks like a diffeomorphism plus a correction. There was a typo in the notes, sorry. Now, although it's cumbersome, you can show that this transformation, which is sort of a bosonic super diffeomorphism, the super version of a diffeomorphism, does indeed have this property. But it follows from the fact that F, V does, that the fermionic one does. Because V of G and V of F map d theta to a multiple of itself, the same remains true of this. Okay. So now I can try to write down an action which has this symmetry. So now, usually, when you try to write down actions which are invariant under diffeomorphisms, you need a metric, right? A theory of gravity. So you might ask, what do you need to write down actions invariant under super diffeomorphisms? And the answer is that you need a theory of supergravity. So it's a theory which has a metric and another fermionic field, which is the gauge connection for the fermionic transformations. This is called, as I said, a gravitino. Now, writing theories of supergravity is an art. There is no fully systematic way. And people have painfully built over the years theories of supergravity in various dimensions, all the way to 11. It's an art because when you write down your action, you start writing an action for the, say, bosonic fields, then you activate the supersymmetry, you try to add fermionic fields that compensate for the variation of the bosonic fields, and then you look at the supersymmetry variation of the fermionic fields, of things bilinear in the fermionic fields, and you discover that you need something with four powers of fermionic fields, and so on and so forth. And at all steps, intricate identities of gamma matrices are needed to make things work, and which are very dimension specific. So in each dimension, you had to do things almost from scratch. Although once you define theory in some number of dimensions, you can always try to sort of reduce to get some of the theories in lower dimensions. In any case, here we're working 1D, so things are simpler. Still quite pesky. Now, in generic dimension, this is a spin 2 field metric. The gravitino is a spin 3/2 field. In one dimension, the spin is not really well defined, so it doesn't really matter. But let's remember for the future that so this goes both ways. In quantum field theory, whenever you have a massless spin 2 field, you have a theory of gravity. And whenever there is a variant of this theorem that tells you whenever you have a massless spin 3/2 field, you have a supergravity. There must be a gauge symmetry, which is super diffeomorphisms. Okay, so with enough patience, we can try to write an action which has inside now this x, this psi, and have one bane and some fermionic superpartner. And which is as the invariant under super diffeomorphisms. And which can be gauge fixed. To our action, this is a function of x, psi, tau, and zeta. So, now I could sketch for you at least how would you potentially build such an action. So I wanted to keep this for a moment. So first of all, we can use the definition here to see how our fields transform. So just acting with this vector field over our y of u and theta gives us something like f of u psi minus f of u x dot theta, which means that the transformation of psi maps to x. So the summation, sorry, the superdiffeomorphism of x gives us psi. And super diffeomorphism acting on psi gives us minus x, gives us x dot. The only difference is that now there is a function of time multiplying the transformation. So we could I really need to use it from Blackboard. We could start from the bosonic action we had before and try to figure out how to make it supersymmetric. So if I act with this delta F transformation, right, I'm going to get two terms. I could be varying these, or I could be varying these. Let me remove the 1/2. If I vary these, I just get something like 2 inverse F x dot psi dot, right? I said wrong. X dot, and then the time derivative of F psi. Sorry. Right. And then I might have an extra term, which is the variation of this. So I can try to compensate for at least part of these transformations by the obvious harmonic action. I think I had some mistakes in the note that I never got around to correct yet. So I want to be careful here. But I think this is OK. There are questions of how, I'm a little bit, that's fine for now. I mean, we could check if this is sensible by also looking at how usual diffeomorphisms act on the on psi. Because here, because I had an x dot squared, I needed a factor of the metric just to take care of the usual diffeomorphisms. I worry a little bit that depending on how I define psi, I mean, if psi transformed in a trivial way under diffeomorphisms, then this x dot will be enough to compensate the transformation of the measure. So I wonder if perhaps in the notes I should not have included this. On the other hand, if psi transforms as a spinner of some sort, so that it has an extra Jacobian, then this would be more sensible. I need to double check which transformation was most sensible. Sorry about that. But I think this is quite reasonable in the sense that when you vary these, you're going to definitely get something which can cancel this term. Because when you vary psi, you're going to get an x dot. But you get other things. And you can get rid of most of the unwanted things by something analogous to this term in the action. So last time I did the calculation, it seemed to me that I could make things work by an action which looks like this. So a gravitino coupling. And that this action will be invariant if the metric transforms into the gravitino, and the gravitino transforms into the metric, and the derivative of the metric plus a correction. See, the gravitino is supposed to be a gauge field for the fermionic transformations. So you see this fact by the fact that it transforms almost the same way as x and psi did. but with an extra term that is the derivative of the gauge parameter, right? It's precisely as gauge field, the way gauge field transform. Okay. Now, if you look at, so under these transformations, there are two sort of gauge invariant quantities. One we encountered before was the integral of E. But now there is a new one, which is the integral of E squared chi. Because the, you can check the variation of this total derivative. And so if you gauge fix this action, you can go back here, and then you ultimately make, you know, convince yourself that this expression can be mapped to an integral in the tau, the zeta of a path integral with super diffeomorphism symmetry. Okay, so all this lengthy discussion was had the purpose of motivating how to define superstring theory. So the idea is to try to define something like this. You know, somewhat, and then go back. So it is definitely possible to write down a supersymmetric generalization of the Nambu-Goto or Polyakov actions. The supersymmetric generalization of the Polyakov action will be an action that depends on the embedding of your worksheet in space-time, but it will be a super worksheet. It will be a worksheet which has both bosonic and fermionic coordinates. And instead of a metric on the worksheet, we have a metric and a gravitino on the worksheet. So you need a two-dimensional supergravity. Now, two-dimensional supergravity is really pesky, but after you gauge fix, the super diffeomorphisms, so everything can be done in parallel with the bosonic case. When you gauge, you can gauge fix things to a local frame, local gauge where the metric is flat and the gravitino vanishes. You cannot do it globally, but you can do it locally. And different patches are glued together by some super coordinate transformations, which are analogous to conformal transformations. And so that place is the place where we want to start our analysis. Okay. So it turns out that the supersymmetric version of coordinate transformations is perfectly analogous to one-dimensional super diffeomorphisms. So once you go to the conformal gauge, you have local coordinates, z and theta, and z bar and theta bar. And you have conformal transformations, which look like maps from z to z of the prime of z and theta. And theta goes to theta prime of z and theta, which preserve the theta, which is defined in the same way as before, by scaling. So notice that the same way as conformal transformations somehow of z do not depend on z bar. Conformal transformation here depend on z and theta, but not on z bar and theta bar. So the z bar and theta bar do their own thing. So if you understand one-dimensional super diffeomorphisms, then for free you understand also super Virasoro. two-dimensional, complex super transformations. And the structure of the of the theory remains very analogous. So, for example, when we describe the motion of the worksheet in space-time, in normal space-time, right, this is important. We are making the worksheet supersymmetric in analogy with the superparticle. We are not doing anything fancy to the actual space-time. So in our initial definition of the theory, space-time will not have a symmetry, will not be supersymmetric. Only the worksheet is supersymmetric. But later on, we'll discover there is a gravitino in the spectrum in the most interesting supersymmetric theories, which means that the space-time theory is also supersymmetric. But that's logically independent from the supersymmetry we put on the worksheet. And it's important not to confuse the two. The supersymmetry we put in the worksheet is just something we put in building up our worksheet theory. It can give rise to theories which are supersymmetric in space-time too, or theories which are not supersymmetric in space-time. And conversely, there are alternative formulations of superstring theory which do not have worksheet supersymmetry, but still have superstring in space-time. So keep the two notions separate. Now, the basic fields now are going to be some square fields. Which will contain the usual scalar fields describing the motion of the worksheet in space-time, and then some partners. Something like that. And similarly, the ghosts too will come with super partners. So we'll have, so besides the usual BC ghosts, we'll have some super partners, beta and gamma. Whenever you have a supersymmetric theory, the stress tensor also has a partner. So because you have a metric and a gravitino, and the variation with respect to the metric, of the action with respect to the metric is to the stress tensor, the variation of the action with respect of the gravitino will give you a new current, the current for supersymmetry, which is called the supercurrent. So our stress tensor will come together with some fermionic partner. So everything will come in pairs, one boson, one fermion, with the same properties in space-time. See, these fermions are still have still Lorentz indices in space-time, much the same as there, but different properties on the worksheet. So these ones would be scalar fields, and you can argue that these are spinors on the worksheet. These have dimension 2, this is dimension minus 1, this is dimension 3/2, and this is dimension minus 1/2. The stress tensor has dimension 2, this is dimension 3/2. Because somehow theta has dimension 1/2. You know, the theta wants to be a square root of the z. So, essentially. Now, a few final observations. So, right here, in the case of the particle, gauge fixing, you know, the stress tensor was just the energy, right? And so in the bosonic case, the gauge fixing, the equations for the metric, leftover equations of the metric told us that the Hamiltonian vanishes, which means that the state, physical states are on shell. In this case, now there are also the equations for the gravitino, which tells you that the supercharge vanishes. And so the physical state satisfies the correct on-shell condition. And notice that because Q squared is H, this on-shell condition implies this. Now, in similar ways, when we do superstring theory, after we go to the conformal gauge, we are left with a statement that the stress tensor will have to vanish, but also the supercurrent will have to vanish. And in the BRST formalism, this just comes about because the BRST variation of the stress tensor of B is T, so T is exact, and the BRST variation of beta gives you G. So G has to be exact. G is exact and essentially vanishes. So everything is done in parallel to the bosonic case. So in order to find what superstring theories look like, we'll have to do two things. We'll have to learn how to quantize fermions on the worksheet. And we'll have to learn what are the consequences of the, what are the physical states in this theory of bosons and fermions. Okay. When you compute things like the critical dimension, of course, now you have to take into account the central charge of everything. Right? The total central charge should be zero because the stress tensor has to vanish. It's exact, sorry. And now you need to just sort of count the contribution from all the fields. So each scalar field contributes one, each fermion contributes 1/2. The BC Gauss contribute minus 26. The beta gamma Gauss contribute 11. So this plus this must contribute 15. It turns out that each of these contributes 1/2. I probably already said it. Right. So 3/2 times the number of dimension should be 15. And so you learn that the critical dimension is 10. So superstring theories will live naturally in 10 dimensions. Okay, do you have any questions? I mean, this was mostly supposed to be inspirational, so it's not clear how much of this content you actually need.
So these fermion fields, they're also holomorphic and anti-holomorphic?
Right, so the equations of motion for the fermions will tell you that psi is holomorphic and psi bar is anti-holomorphic. Another way to think about it is that there, if you do the theta of y, this is holomorphic in the same way as del x was holomorphic. And indeed, inside the theta of y, you find psi minus theta dx. I can also perhaps say that the stress tensor is dx dx plus psi d psi thematically, and the supercurrent is psi dx. Any other questions? I mean, the biggest challenge really would be just to understand properly how to quantize fermions. There are some fun subtleties because fermions can spin 1/2. So they transform with the square root of the Jacobian, which makes the sign of fermions kind of a subtle thing when you assemble your worksheets. In particular, you need to always consider two different sectors. I mean, the Hilbert space decomposes into sectors, so the fermions are periodic or anti-periodic. And it takes a bit of thinking to figure out which sectors actually contribute to the theory. There are some interesting subtleties there, which are that in a sense can teach you a lot about what does it mean to actually define a theory in two dimensions or any dimensions. And again, if you are interested in learning subject in condensed matter physics or high energy theory, where subtleties about defining theories properly are important, here you can find some interesting examples of that. But anyway, it's not going to be too difficult, but it's crucial because the subtleties of deciding which states are in and which are not in the theory is the key that allows to eliminate the tachyon. So in assembling the theory, we'll have a bit of freedom, and this freedom can be used to make sure the tachyon is not there and the final theory is sensible. And so there are a bunch of discrete choices you can make, which gives rise to different string theories. We'll see something called type 2A, type 2B, type 0A, type 0B. Some of those theories have no tachyon, some have tachyon. Perhaps the last thing I can mention is that here I made a choice of having both nullomorphic and antilomorphic theta. There is an alternative choice where you only put one theta and not the other. It's called a terotic string. So sort of half of the terotic string looks like a superstring, the other half looks like a bosonic string. And that gives yet another way to build interesting and meaningful string theories. But probably, I'm not sure how much we'll be able to say about them. But anyway, between today, tomorrow, and the day after tomorrow, we should be able to get a reasonable definition of type 2 string theory and perhaps heterotic. And possibly in the last lecture, we can discuss a little bit the dualities that relate them.